Joining me now to talk all things Ukraine, he's the former advisor to the SecDef under President Trump, our good pal, retired Army Colonel Doug McGregor. Oh, Doug, I'm feeling a little feisty today. And I'm just throwing it all out there. I mean, you know, I heard somebody the other day concerning the Ukraine war and the ramp up and should they belong to NATO and should we send more money? Well, we have to. It pushes back on those damn Russians and puts them in their place. And we've been fighting them since the Cold War and blah, 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 blah. And I just looked at them and I said, you do realize that Ukraine has been corrupt forever. You do realize that we've made promises to Russia and NATO has over the decades about Ukraine joining NATO and the boundaries. And we've lied and broken almost every promise to them. And they thought I was insane. I see your
reaction. Well, the truth hasn't been real popular lately, let's face it.
Yeah.
The lies coming out of the administration are enormous. And sadly, despite the Russia hoax, people continue to believe what they hear through the television from just about anybody. And that's one of our big problems. This particular meeting in Vilnius is very important because the Russians are watching to see what comes out of it. And thus far, we have a couple of things. First of all, we haven't said, no, Ukraine cannot join NATO. What we've said, actually, is that the two-step process is now going to become a one-step process. Of course, with the caveat that you can then join when the war is over. The second part, though, is very, very important. And that is that the members are now supposedly openly discussing war plans against Russia. Now, this kind of thing is extremely sensitive, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
You can imagine the impact on Moscow. Thus far, Putin has held 300,000 troops in reserve, you know, hoping that he doesn't have to commit them because he's always worried about NATO intervention. And at the same time, you have the Poles and Lithuanians who are saying, well, we're going to go in regardless of what the NATO alliance says. And if we go in, we're not really going to drag NATO with us. The problem with that, of course, is that they're part of NATO. And if they do go in, the Russians will treat them as a NATO Trojan horse and they will attack. Mm-hmm. So we're really on the path to war. And I think we ought to start asking some hard questions of this man who's 80 years old, who has trouble finding his way off the stage, about what he's actually doing. I mean, we're in the hands of a man who is not entirely mentally stable. Am I right?
You are correct. I mean, look, Colonel, all the naysayers can say whatever they want, but we see it every single day. Every time this man is up there on the world stage with the cameras rolling, it's either doing the straight arm shuffle, which we know is a big sign of the beginning onsets of dementia. I've talked with experts. We've had him on this program. Losing his place, as you said, on the stage, figuring out where he goes. And then just the speech. He just spoke, what was it, yesterday or the day before he flew over to the summit. And he couldn't remember what in the hell he was even talking about. And he tries to then wiggle his way out of the mumble jumble that comes out of his mouth and in his head. And this is supposed to be the leader of the free world, the most powerful man in the world with the codes to the nukes. I'm scared as hell looking at what we're facing with Ukraine and Russia.
Well, I think you should be, and I think everybody in the United States ought to ask, what are we doing? What are our interests in Ukraine? Mm-hmm. We don't really have any interests per se there. If you're going to argue this is about democracy, well, that's ridiculous. Right now, the Ukrainian state, what there is left of it, is more totalitarian than anything we've seen since Stalin. There's nothing there for us whatsoever. Most Europeans want nothing to do with this. So why is everyone so interested in going to war with Russia? I haven't figured it out. We don't have enough ammunition for our own forces. We have very few ground forces, very small numbers. If this gets out of hand, we are not in a position to match Russian military power on the ground. And if we can't do that, what do we do?
Well, the global elites that want
nuclear weapons?
Well, the global elites that want a one world government, a one world currency, don't like people that are nationalists. And we know Putin loves his mother Russia and is a nationalist for his nation. And again, I know he's a murderous thug. I'm not going to say nice things about him, but I'll say one positive. He is all in on Mother Russia, which I wish we had leaders here that were all in on the United States of America. But the problem is we have these global elites and we have leaders like a Biden that have taken money from the rest of them. And to me, they want this big reset and they want to rule the globe under one thumb and we're all their minions and their sheep. And Putin doesn't go for that. So take that guy out. That's my feeling. I don't know. Why else would they want to take him out?
Well, no, I think you're right. But increasingly, we are becoming a third world country. We no longer trust the FBI. I mean, the FBI used to be one of those institutions that held absolute, total, and complete confidence of the American people.
True.
Now, people are all saying, well, if they come to your door, whatever you do, don't talk to them and call an attorney right away. I mean, this is a very sick development in our country. And of course, we're not enforcing the laws. The whole point is that today, if you are an American and you do not necessarily agree with the administration and its policies, and you voice that, you are at risk.
Yep.
If you deal with the police.
I know.
It's a terrible thing.
I'm worried, and I'm still wondering and waiting when they're going to knock on our door at OAN or my personal door off the stuff that we say on this network. I'm amazed. Maybe it's only because we're public and so they don't. But you see what happens to private individuals who are putting this kind of stuff out on their social media pages. It literally goes from being blocked online to that knock on the door. You brought up ammunitions. Colonel, I got to ask you this, since you command a lot of troops. So last week we discussed every single branch except the Marine Corps is missing the mark on recruitment. The numbers are depleted in the Army, as you said, down to it's like we're scraping the bottom of the barrel. Nobody can get in because kids aren't mentally or physically fit to get in. And then the ammunition thing. And I want to get your take on this. Joe Biden said this on a talk show the other night about sending those damn cluster bombs that we weren't going to send because a year ago when we heard Russia was using them, we said that's a war crime. But now we're sending them. And he admits we're out of ammo on live TV. Listen to this.
This is a war relating to munitions and the running out of that ammunition. And we're low on it.
Yeah. And we're low on it.
The first question. Yeah, well, the first question is, where's the Secretary of Defense? Where's the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs? Where are the Chiefs of Staff? They have an obligation to ensure that our war stocks are adequate.
Mm-hmm.
They have an obligation to ensure that if we have to suddenly fight, no one is going to lack for ammunition or body armor or a whole range of things. But we know that's not the case. And these cluster munitions, those things are old. We haven't used them for a very long time and for good reasons. First of all, they weren't that effective. They had a huge dud rate.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, they were more trouble than they were because as you advanced, it wasn't a problem for tanks and armored fighting vehicles, but anyone in a wheeled vehicle, in a truck or a Humvee, was at risk. And then, obviously, civilians, especially children, were mm-hmm. attracted to these bright, shiny objects on the floor that looked like baseballs, and they harmed themselves. And we said, we're not going to use them anymore. Well, apparently, we have nothing else to send.
Wow.
Someone needs to be fired. Someone needs to be fired. Obviously, we know the man at the top needs to go away.
Yeah.
He needs to be sent to a nice place where he can meet with his grandchildren from time to time.
All grandkids.
But the rest of these characters, yeah, the rest of these, yeah, right. The rest of these people, they should be held accountable, but no one on the Hill cares. You see, I think there's this feeling that we can provoke the Russians, we can bully the Russians, and nothing really bad will happen. They're wrong. We're on a bad road right now, a dangerous road. For the first time, I really think we're on the road to war with Russia.
Wow.
And someone needs to put a stop to it.
Where's Reagan when you need him?
Okay, so lots going on in the war in Ukraine. The first thing was the big announcement on Friday that the Pentagon intends to send cluster munitions to Ukraine. Now, this is very controversial because cluster munitions have been banned by quite a few countries. There was a treaty that was signed. The United States did not sign this, neither did Russia, to ban cluster munitions. Tell us what are cluster munitions? Why are they controversial? And what is the significance of the U.S. wanting to send these over to Ukraine?
We're talking about bomblets. They look about the size of a baseball, and you may have inside one munition 50 to 100 of these. And they are supposed to explode on contact with whatever they strike after they break out of the warhead that fires them from an artillery system. Actually speaking, to understand why we're doing what we're doing, you really need to keep in mind two things. First is desperation. We've largely run out of any more 155-millimeter high-explosive ammunition to send. We don't have it, neither do most of our allies.
we've got backlogs that will take months to fill these requirements. The DPCIM, in other words, these bomblets are available, so we're sending them. Number two, they're not that effective. They're really designed for soft targets. In other words, they're designed principally to maim or harm human beings, destroy tents, destroy light structures, trucks, Humvees. They were devised after Vietnam as a means of dealing with large numbers of people spread over an area in jungle terrain. We weren't able to get to them with precision munitions because we didn't have that much precision then. So the bomblets were useful. Today, we have precision with virtually every munition. It gives you accuracy for point detonation. So you really don't need the bomblets per se. And frankly, in 1991, our experience with them was very mixed. They were actually more trouble to us than they were worth, because after we in armored formations moved through them, where there were many, many duds, they had no impact on us. They couldn't hurt us in an armored fighting vehicle, but they did enormous damage to the wheeled traffic that followed us. And so we continually asked people, don't use this anymore. And then after the war, of course, we treated numerous children and people, just residents of towns and villages that had accidentally stumbled on these things or picked up one of these thinking that it was something you could toss. It exploded and did damage. So there are a lot of good reasons why countries have said, no, stop using this. And right now, the United Kingdom and Germany, I know, have both said, we don't want any part of this. And I happen to agree with them.
So it's almost like laying a minefield in a way. I mean, once these bombs drop and they scatter, and how many did you say are inside?
Well, let's see, you have 150 of these that land in a particular area. And of that number, you may have anywhere from 20 to 30 that never explode. They just don't detonate. And so they present a permanent hazard until someone identifies them and destroys them. So in that sense, they're worse than a mine. Because mines, you know, you find minefields, you can mark a minefield, you can avoid a minefield, and then you have equipment to deal with it. We don't see these bomblets until we're driving through them or over them.
So there's no way to clean it up. Once you've done it, you can't go back and try to figure out, okay, where did these go? Because we don't want children running into these fields and playing with them.
Well, I'm sure that you probably can if you calculate effectively, but the problem is it's a war zone. And no one is going to go out there with a big bag and say, I'm collecting these things.
So what would be the advantage then of Ukraine using these? I mean, besides is it really that we just don't have anything else to give them and this is all we have left? Or is it that these are advantageous to them in some way?
I don't think they'll be of any great advantage to the Ukrainians. Again, it's this desperation. Washington is desperate. London is desperate. And the people in Kyiv are desperate. Ukraine has lost this war. They've taken anywhere from 300,000 to 350,000 dead. These are dead Ukrainian soldiers. How many hundreds of thousands of wounded there are is anybody's guess. The point is that they're running out of equipment, running out of ammunition, and running out of manpower.
Why do you think this war is taking so long? I think many of us in the very beginning of this war back in February of 2022 thought this is just going to be several weeks. And then it's going to be over. And yet here we are a year and a half later and it's still going. What do you think the reason is for that?
I think there are two reasons. First of all, most of us thought that the Russians would go into Ukraine with a vengeance, that they would effectively destroy Ukrainian units in their barracks. They would pulverize anything they ran into, and they would try to rush through whatever lines they encountered to come to terms or close combat with the Ukrainians. The opposite was the case. Putin gave very strict guidance that there was to be little or no collateral damage. You were not supposed to shoot anyone unless you could identify them as a Ukrainian soldier. And he actually wanted to give as many Ukrainian soldiers as possible the opportunity to surrender. Well, the Ukrainians turned out to be very formidable. There were almost 400,000 of them that we had equipped and trained. And they decided to pull into towns and cities and effectively fortify themselves. This caused their ultimate annihilation, because once you sit in a fortified place, you could be surrounded, isolated, starved, whatever, and eventually destroyed. So it didn't work, but it was something the Russians were not prepared for. They also decided, when they couldn't find anyone who would negotiate, some of your listeners will remember that in late March, Ukrainian President Zelensky said that, well, I think we could probably live with neutrality, which was one of the key demands of the Russians. They just wanted a neutral state on their border, not a member of NATO. They didn't want to see U.S. missiles show up in eastern Ukraine that could threaten their own nuclear deterrent. Well, ultimately that failed because Boris Johnson flew in from London with instructions from Biden to make sure no agreement was reached. Mm-hmm. So suddenly the Russians are standing and saying, well, this is going to drag on now. We only have about 220,000 men in our army. We have about 134,000 draftees. This isn't going to work. So they went over to the defensive. They tried to occupy all the territory that was essentially Russian in terms of population, which they've done. But then they said, we can't continue this. We need more forces. So they went on to the defensive. They conducted this as an economy of force mission and let the Ukrainians essentially smash themselves to bits trying to defeat the Russian defenses. That's why it's taken so long.
Yeah, and the counteroffensive right now with Ukraine is not going well. In fact, Zelensky even said, he admitted this on Wednesday when he was talking to the BBC, he said that the counteroffensive is slower than desired. And he said some people believe this is a Hollywood movie and expect results, but it's not. So they're not going very well. From their perspective, from the Ukrainian perspective, how much longer, I mean, even with these cluster munitions, how much longer can they go? What would they need? I mean, are we talking like the next step is nukes?
No, I hope not. And I don't think there's any evidence that the Russians would launch any nuclear weapons. Or for that matter, I don't see any evidence that we will. We both understand the consequences. There's no such thing as a small nuke. You know, you explode a tactical nuclear weapon, 5 kilotons or less. Everybody's supposed to stand around and say, oh, well, don't worry about that. That's a small nuke. No, what happens is that everybody says, we better use what we have before we lose it, and you get Armageddon. I don't see that happening. So, no, that's not the answer. The second thing is, Ukrainians, as I said, are running out of ammunition, people, equipment. They're losing everything that we send to them faster than they can employ it effectively. And you can't build an army on the fly. You have to have an organization in place, an institution. Those things never existed. So the Ukrainians at this point will continue to try and demonstrate that there's life left in them. But the truth is, if the Russians attack, they'll be swept away. And they know that. They will die in a hail of incredible artillery fire, rocket fire, missile fire, and they'll be overrun by hundreds of thousands of Russian troops. So the question is, what happens in Vilnius at this meeting? Are we finally going to come to terms with reality? Will we negotiate an end to this, or do we force the Russians to do what they really don't want to do, which is attack? I mean, they'd like to end this war without a terrible bloodbath beyond what already exists.
Okay, but you know the military-industrial complex, the hawks, the warmongers, they've been saying there is no way we can let Russia win. And what is Russia winning? So could they maybe spare themselves by spinning it and saying, okay, Russia can keep the land that they've already basically taken at this point, and this somehow they can, is there a way to spin that as a loss for Russia so that we can get out of this? Because I don't know how we're going to get out of this when they've been saying this whole time, Russia cannot win. We must ensure they lose.
Look, there are two realities here. One is that the European populations, even the Polish population, is opposed to direct war with Russia. So there's no appetite to go in there with large numbers of U.S. or European forces. Now, the Poles and Lithuanians are talking about trying to do something independent of NATO. That won't work. The Russians will regard that as a NATO threat, and they will be destroyed. So I hope someone with a clear head puts an end to that nonsense. The second thing to keep in mind is most Americans don't care. They're not even watching. They've got their minds focused on all sorts of domestic problems. So the notion that if the president were to announce the Ukrainians have given all they can, it is time to end this tragedy. There is no point in any further loss of life. I think most Americans would say, well, that's great. They don't care. It's the people in Washington that don't want to admit that they were wrong. All of their assumptions from the beginning were wrong. The goal of destroying Russia and forcing Putin out of office was ridiculous. It was silly. And we're now out of ammunition. And we don't have the forces to send in there. The Russians have 300,000 troops in reserve ready to attack. We have nothing like that.
But doesn't it make us look bad? I mean, here we are saying, flexing our muscles, saying we're the mightiest military in the world. And now if Russia ends up ultimately winning, yeah, I mean, what does that say for us?
It's a little late. You know, we look ridiculous as it is, in my judgment. I mean, mm-hmm. if you go walk the streets of Berlin a year ago, people were saying, oh, well, this is terrible what the Russians have done. Now on the streets of Berlin, people are saying, what, are the Poles insane? Are the Americans insane? We don't want a major war in Europe and we don't need it. And remember that before this began, Russia had a very small army. Now it has an army of at least 750,000 with brand new weapons ready to strike. I mean, the Russians have practically mobilized the country. We're nowhere near that. It would take us months to catch up. It's time to be realistic. They have more in this game than we do. What happens in Ukraine is existential for them. For us, it's like Cuba or Mexico. Mm-hmm. But for them, it's everything. For us, Ukraine is nothing. We want the best for the people. That's about it.
That's peace. What we should want. Right. And peace, definitely ending this war in peace would be the best thing for the Ukrainian people. Is Lindsey Graham an idiot? Well, here's the thing. So he has tweeted out saying, I will be working with Republicans and Democrats in the Senate to pass a resolution urging the admission of Ukraine into NATO. The best way to prevent future wars and promote peace is to create security guarantees that make aggressor nations think twice before starting wars. Ukrainian NATO membership is vital to the future security of Europe and the world. I believe there's an overwhelming majority of senators supporting this proposition, he says. But he's now facing rebuke from Republicans in the House and the Senate because they're saying, no, this isn't actually what we want. Why is Lindsey Graham so out of step with the rest of the Republicans? Is he just more bought off by the military-industrial complex than the rest, or what's the deal here?
I think you always need to identify the donors. There are major donors out there, oligarchs in the Western sense, billionaires, mm-hmm. Zuckerberg, Gates. There are many, many others beyond that. Look at the hedge fund managers that are billionaires. Where does their money go? What do they want? We have a ruling class that hates Russia, that wants to destroy it, then wants to strip it of its resources and exploit it for profit. That's what it's about. He's simply saying what his donors want him to say. Now, he's a combat lawyer, remember? So he understands everything there is about warfare. He's been under fire many times. He knows what it is like to watch American soldiers die or be wounded in foreign lands, doesn't he? No, he doesn't. The second part is that the rest of the world right now looks upon us as the aggressor. Most of the world sees what Russia is doing and doesn't see it in those terms. If Russia were the aggressor, things would have been different right now in Ukraine. That place would look like a parking lot, and the Russians would be well on their way to the Polish border. That hasn't happened, and that's not what the Russians want. The Russians, especially Mr. Putin, wants to be able to live with his neighbors when the war ends. We don't seem to care about that. So what we've left behind us is a trail of hatred and destruction in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya. That's not what Putin is interested in doing in Europe. So that's why the whole notion of, well, if we don't stop the Russians now, they'll go straight through. That's a lot of nonsense. This is 2023, not 1903, not 1983. The world really is different. We need to look at it through a different lens.
Yeah. One other thing I think why Lindsey Graham is kind of an idiot in pushing for this is that it would be in the Republicans' best interest if this war ended under Biden, right? I mean, we saw what happened with the withdrawal of Afghanistan. That was a disaster for Biden. It was done in a very disastrous way. I definitely wanted to see the end of that war for sure, but didn't like the way it was handled. This would be a gift to Republicans if this ended under Biden. And it was like, look at Biden. He's failed us completely. Rather than rolling this into the next administration, which very well would be a Republican administration, many of us believe, and then having to have the Republican end it, and then Russia wins. I mean, it just seems like you'd want to back down now as a Republicans, you would think would want this. But my question is, you've been in the military for a long time. You were on the battlefield. How can How does the United States move forward with this military, the way the military industrial complex? Like, what, how should we re-envision? Because we're not winning. We're, look at, we can't even beat the Taliban, a bunch of people in the, you know, random fighters in mountains. We're not winning wars. We haven't won wars in so long. And now here we are, another mistake. What is the future for the military, for the United States?
Our military is at a low ebb. We spend more money than anyone else in the world. In fact, more money than the top 10 powers in the world on defense. We believe that if you shove enough money into the Defense Department, you're going to get competence, capability, military power out of it. That's not true. Again, we have 44 four-star generals on active duty, 44 generals and admirals, four stars. We have 1.12 million people under arms. In 1943, we had 12.2 million under arms. We only had seven four-stars, generals and admirals. One wonders how we possibly won the Second World War with only seven four-stars. Aren't we lucky that we have 44 today? What's my point? My point is this is a bloated bureaucracy. The numbers of people who actually deploy and fight are minimal. And now we have destroyed morale. We are undermining discipline with all of this wokeism and nonsense. The military has been turned into a social experiment. It's designed to make people in Washington happy, and they think it's making their constituents happy. Oh, look at my daughter, Susie. She's a warrior. It's a lot of nonsense. We're living in a fantasy world. The Russians would go right through us. Let's wake up. They're serious. We're not. So what has to happen? We've got to go after this military establishment. It needs to be reduced. And then we need to come to terms with another reality. The defense industries are businesses. It's in their interest to make as much money as possible. Who's watching it? Nobody. Nobody's questioning anything because people on the Hill are pocketing a lot of cash by going along with bad programs and bad policies. So the whole military establishment needs to be reduced. You've got to get it back down to a lean fighting machine. Then you can begin really reforming it, reorganizing it, and changing the way we command and control it, the way we recruit for it. That's going to take us years. It will take us 5 to 10 years to recover, I would say, from the last 20 years, and certainly from the last 2.5.
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely many of us want to see a reduction in all of this, but I don't know how we're going to do that, since it is business and people are out there making money and they've got jobs and billions of dollars in the pocket.
Nassim Taleb tells us that we're staring financial Armageddon in the face.
Yeah.
I would listen to Nassim Taleb and what he says. I would listen to James Ricards. These are people who are warning us about printing money and raising interest rates. They're warning us about the use of monetary policy to fix structural problems in the economy. Can't be done. Something's got to give. And we haven't even talked about the border. We haven't talked about the rule of law, the criminality in our cities. What are we doing in Ukraine? There's nothing there for us to do. Everything that we need to do is here at home. And most of the world is eminently capable of defending itself. And contrary to popular belief, there are not large armies, navies, and air forces in China and Russia just waiting for the opportunity to invade somebody else. Nothing could be further from the truth.
I want to wrap up now by talking about Prigozhin. What in the world is going on with this? So we saw a mutiny, a supposed mutiny that lasted a day or less than a day. We did see airmen killed, maybe about a dozen of Russian airmen. Nobody was arrested for that. There didn't seem to be any repercussion for those lives lost. Prigozhin then was supposedly exiled into Belarus. Lukashenko made a deal and brought him over to Belarus, supposedly. But now we're hearing reports that he actually met with Putin 5 days after this supposed mutiny, and he's now apparently roaming free in Russia. I mean, they're saying that he's been spotted in Moscow, he's been spotted in St. Petersburg, that he's just, Lukashenko said he's not in the territory of Belarus, so he's even said he's not here, and he's been spotted all over Russia. So what in the world, what happened and what is going on? Was this just a ruse? Was this real? Because now I'm starting to think the whole thing was a plot to maybe root out treasonous generals on the Russian side.
Well, I think Prigozhin is a natural reality TV star. And I'm sure someone in Hollywood has got his number and will find a way to bring him over so he can have his own reality TV show. The man's very entertaining, but he's not stupid. And the second part is that some of it was real, but a lot of it was not what we thought it was. And there is some evidence that it may have been staged, but I can't tell you that because I don't have access to the kind of intelligence that would substantiate it. What we know is it was not an uprising. We know it was not a coup. Nobody joined Prigozhin. Nobody. People saw what Prigozhin was doing, and people had heard him before. And what did he say? We're not fighting this war the right way. That's his criticism. These generals at the top are slow, old men, grandpas. They don't want to come to terms with what's out there. Let's go crush these Ukrainians. That made him enormously popular in Russia. And he said he wanted to get to Vladimir Putin and explain to him he's got to change things or we will drag this war out longer than we want to. So what did he do? His forces were not in contact with the enemy. They were in reserve. He went down to Rostov, the theater headquarters. He had a discussion there with one of the deputy commanding generals. Then he said, well, send 3,000-4,000 guys to Moscow, and then I'll go up there and talk to Putin and see if I can get him to understand that we need to ramp up this war and end it. Well, they were on their way up there, and apparently without direct orders from President Putin, an Air Force general decided to send helicopters out there to intercept them. And you had this tragedy where Russians were killing Russians. It was immediately ended. Prigozhin said, stop, this is not what this is all about. In the West, everybody said, oh, wonderful, this is what we've been waiting for. Putin's going to be removed. This is a rebellion. It's all nonsense. So where is he now? He's in Luhansk in Ukraine. That's where the Wagner group is. They're going to move to Belarus, where they are building barracks for them. Where is Prigozhin? He's in St. Petersburg. Yes, he was with Putin in Moscow. He and 35 of his officers sat and talked to Putin for 3 hours. I'm sure Putin got an earful, but Putin knows these men are Russian patriots. They fought hard for Russia. They will fight hard for Russia again.
So, I mean, is Putin being soft, or is this, or do you think that, because to march on Moscow, to have airmen die, I mean, we just saw how our own government behaved on January 6th, about January 6th. I mean, they were people that were just sightseeing are in jail and considered traitors to the country who were trying to, you know, commit insurrection. I mean, this was a much bigger deal, and yet Prigozhin's just hanging around in St. Petersburg and they're having meetings for 3 hours, which is like coffee. I mean, or do you think that maybe this was a little bit different than the way we're interpreting it, at least the way the West interpreted it?
During World War II, George Patton frequently spoke out and was very critical of the conduct of the war by Eisenhower and others. Sometimes he used names, sometimes he didn't. When he slapped a soldier, there was an opportunity to take Patton completely out of the war, send him back to Washington, reduce him in rank, and so forth. What did we do? We didn't do that. We didn't do it because Patton was effective and Patton was very popular. We had similar problems with MacArthur. Eventually, Truman removed MacArthur, and that was hell to pay in Washington when he did that. Not because they didn't think MacArthur had spoken out of turn, and he had, but because he was a national hero. Everybody loved him. He delivered victory at Incheon. They didn't like the way he was treated. Putin avoided all of that. He avoided all of it because he knows the Wagner Group has utility. It has value. They're a niche capability. They're very good in urban operations, very good at digging out the enemy in critical places. That's what they demonstrated. So was this staged? It may have been. I don't know. But I do think we're going to see a shakeup in the senior ranks in the high command. And I think a decision will come after this meeting in Vilnius, depending upon what comes out of that, regarding what the Russians do next. And they're positioned right now to launch a devastating offensive.
Well, Colonel McGregor, thank you so much for joining us tonight and giving us your insight on this. Always a pleasure hearing from you. Heard from you on many other shows. Glad to see you here on this show. So really appreciate that.
Nice to see you.
And yeah, you've written a lot of books. I'm just curious, do you have I know you've written Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle of 73 Easting, but do you have, you've written a lot of books. Like what's the book you would say people should read if they really want to get some insight into the military or...
Well, you might want to look at the last one called Margin of Victory that came out 2016 or 14, I can't remember. But it covers battles that, that had a huge impact on how we fight wars. And they marked changes in warfare. And I was trying to understand what had happened between 1914 and 1991. And that's something that we really didn't do. The Russians are now giving a good demonstration of just how much has changed. Mm. And the Russians are depicted in that book as being far ahead of us. And I talk in detail about it. So I think Americans would profit from looking at that book more than any other right now.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.